when the person next to you gets a little bit ahead or behind. What happens?
It stresses you out.
It kind of stresses you out, right? You have to like tune them out to tune in what you're doing yourself. But that's actually, right, this is easy. This is, I think, an athlete with a very clear mind. So now we're going to take the strip test.
Oh, jeez.
So same word, same font, but now instead of reading the word, you have to say the color.
Oh, God.
Right? So you have to say blue, red, green, blue, whatever.
It's not blue. Is it
blue?
Blue,
purple, whatever. It's all the color.
Are you colorblind?
There's all the color snob in the room. We're like, hey, Asher. This is purple, that's blue. Whatever. All right.
I can't figure that out. It's
so, out loud, as a room. Yes.
To clarify a question, that first one is blue.
Whatever you want. Purple. You know what's amazing is I've done this a lot, and it's amazing how these colors change based on how new the projector is.
Or how colorblind the audience
is. Or how colorblind the audience is. So you can call whatever you want, sir, you'll still make my point. All right, so out loud as fast as we can go. Don't read the word, say the color. On your marks, get set, go.
Purple, red, orange, purple, yellow, purple, pink, green, green, yellow, red, pink, yellow, green, pink, purple, red, green, pink, yellow, red, pink, yellow, purple.
I suck at that. I'm so bad at that. You were good at that. You're cheating.
You want to know your time?
Oh my God, people are stuck on me. All
right, now I ask you to be honest. Raise your hand if you quit. All
right. Oh my God, I'm quitting.
This, right, is this Stroop effect. You add that little bit of cognitive interference, and it slows down reaction time, right? So when we think about all the things that can interfere with any athlete, right, but a skier especially, right, when they're riding that lift, when they're getting in the gate, it's all in their head, right? And if the thing in their head is not clear, if they don't have those mental skills to clear their mind, if they're thinking about, if I race badly, what is my mom or my dad going to say at the bottom, right? The words in their head are probably the words they hear most often, and I think that comes from us, and that comes from their parents. And so we better be very intentional about what those words are, because that's what they're thinking about those last seconds before they start. And we don't want them skiing like this, right? We want them skiing like this, right? So I think this is one of the biggest things that we can do, is our coaching adding interference, or is it stripping it away? How much can we add, right? When I do assessments of coaches across many sports, usually my biggest thing is that, you know, your practice sometimes has too much content, right? It's too much content that you're trying to get across here, right? And we never check for really understanding. So I think as coaches, we have to be thinking about this, right? We want our skiers skiing with clear mind. And we have a huge influence over whether that happens or whether it doesn't. Right? Now, I have one other thing on the quality coaching front that has made a big difference in my coaching. And I just started doing this recently because I heard about a teacher who was doing this with her class. And so, you know, I do a lot of core value work and stuff with the teams that I coach now, and I'll talk to them about that in a little bit here. But this is what I did this year. When we did our goal setting and we did our values work, I asked all the kids, right now I have, like I said, I've coached college and I worked for an MLS team and all that. Right now I have like the biggest challenge of my coaching career. I have 32 12-year-old girls. Right? But here's what I did at the end. The back of their goal setting sheet, I asked them to finish this sentence for me. One thing that I wish my coaches knew about me that would help them coach me better is dot, dot, dot. You would be amazed what your athletes will put down on that, right? Especially when you have that good connection. You might find out something about their family that you never do, right? They might ask you, you know, could you please just talk to my mom and dad about the car ride home and how miserable it is, right? They might say, you know, I had a girl, right? So again, I coach soccer, right? He said, you know, I don't like when I go first to demonstrate something. I really don't understand it until I see it. And sometimes it's really embarrassing because I have no idea what you're asking me to do. Right? I can handle that request. Kid who says, I really like when you pull me off and you sit down and you talk to me one-on-one about what's going well and what's not versus yelling instructions onto the field. I can handle that request. So you might be incredibly amazed what your athletes, how they finish this sentence for you. And get some insight that just showing up at practice week after week, you might not see, and you can get it on day one, right? And you're really asking them to go deep here and say, tell me something that you don't think I know about you that would help me coach you better. And then when you do that, boy, does that build connection and trust and all those other things that really, really matter, right? So something that, again, in my, what's my 10%, what's my 20%, something that I've added that I feel like really helped me. All right, so the next piece is this idea of culture and values. So 2 years ago, I was presenting to the coaches of Ski Club Vail, and the other coach that day was a man named Christian Mitter, who's the Norwegian men's alpine ski coach. And so he was going on right after me, and I'm just, okay, what's he going to talk about? This is, you know, to me, very fascinating. What do we, you know, this is such an individual sport, what's he going to talk about? And the title of this talk was Culture Comes First. He said, if we get the culture of our team right, what happens? Our athletes take care of themselves on and off the snow. They push each other harder in practice. They sleep well. They eat well. They're constantly challenging each other. When we bring in new people, they pick up, this is what it means to be a Norwegian men's skier, right? The culture comes first. And I think, so even in individual sports, culture matters. Does anyone know who the most successful team is of the professional sports era across all sports, highest winning percentage?
All Blacks.
All Blacks. New Zealand All Blacks. Right? New Zealand All Blacks. 90% winning percentage. A values-based culture. Has anyone read the book Legacy? You like that one? Legacy. 100%. I think any coach has to read that book. It's phenomenal. The fascinating thing about All Blacks is they had this incredible culture, 2 World Cups in a row, all based on values that we're going to talk about in a bit. But then they just had a few issues, right? They had a very influential captain named Richie McCaw who retired, and they never really filled that leadership void. And all of a sudden, they started having a lot of off-the-field issues that chipped away at that culture. But they jumped on it right away, and they just, you know, tossed out the bad apples. But the whole thing about the All Blacks was this, that your job as an All Black player, leave the shirt in a better place than I got. Take the organization forward. My favorite value of the All Blacks, they call it sweep the shed. And this is what that meant, is that at the end of every game they played, 80,000 fans, you know, when the media left, when the fans cleared out, when the coaches were done talking, the All Blacks players sweep the locker room. They sweep up the dirt and the mud because the idea is to be humble. You can never forget to do all the little things that it takes to be great, right? And so if we sweep the locker room every single day, we can never, ever forget that. So these incredible millionaire athletes sweep the locker room, led by their captains, led by the older senior players, setting the example for the younger ones, sweeping the shed. I go to a 10-year-old girl soccer game, and there's cops everywhere. right? It's a mess. I think in the ski world, there's lots of things that our athletes can do that remind them to sweep the shed. Maybe starting with carry your own skis. Right? I remember taking my kids, you know, skiing in the beginning and just like that kind of thing, right? If you can't carry your skis to the slope, maybe we shouldn't be skiing here, right? And you know, I mean, the best advice I ever got was if you got them in snow with their boots on, that counted as a day of skiing. Right? So building a culture in your club, it's not an event, it's not a one-time thing, it's a process, it's something that you do over and over intentionally, day after day, right? It's something that you say, you define, this is who we are, and this is what we do. And it starts with coming up with a set of core values, right? That this is what our organization stands for. Right? And these core values are things that we teach, and we just happen to use skiing to teach it, or soccer to use it, or hockey to use it, or whatever. But we teach these things every day, and we just use the sport as the vehicle. Because that builds loyalty. It gives parents something more than did we win to fixate on. Because you're making the human being better. Right? So the core value is something that defines us. That we are all willing to be held accountable for as a coach, as a parent, as an athlete, as an administrator. Now what happens in most youth sports organizations and even many professional sports organizations is that they are a series of kingdoms. And what I mean by that is that your experience as an athlete usually relies completely on who's your coach. And so some kingdoms are phenomenal and some are not. So my friend Todd, American guy in the soccer world, he married the daughter of a soccer guy named Johan Cruyff. And he went and he's lived in Barcelona for the last 20 years, and he helped Johan start something called the Cruyff Institute. And they do consulting with these big clubs like Barcelona and Ajax and everything. And he said, well, it was really amazing. He went into this club in Holland called Ajax, and their coaches were these famous international players, and he said to them, to the 10 and under coach, he said, what is the most important quality that you look for in a 10 and under Ajax player? And the guy said, humility, do little things. Great. And he went to the 12-year-old coach and he said, and what is the most important thing for you? And he said, you know, bite and grit. And he said, wow. So for this kid, who is honored for being humble, 1 year later, humility doesn't matter anymore. Right? Now it's fight and grit. And again, they're both good qualities, but when you leave one kingdom and go to the other, the things that got you praise in one all of a sudden get you nothing in the other. And how inconsistent is that? In our clubs, we need to have consistent core values that, again, in the context, can mean something different. Being accountable, being fearless, being selfless, whatever they are. Right? They can mean something different for different ages and stages of athletes, but they can still be consistent values that are part of our club, right? That are on the walls, that they're on the shirts, not just a page buried somewhere in our website saying, oh, these are our values. And this is what most organizations do. So my kids go to this, or they went to this elementary school that in Bend, Oregon, so in context, right? It was the worst school. Right, and the worst meaning that 70% of the kids there, there's a big, my kids did a Spanish immersion program, so 70% of the population there was on a free and reduced federal lunch program in the U.S. But this school was amazing because they had amazing leadership and they had amazing core values, and there's three of them: be safe, be kind, be responsible. They were on every shirt, they were on every wall, they did assemblies throughout the year where they taught these things. But the biggest thing was that they rewarded the kids for being those things. So when a teacher caught a kid being safe, being kind, being responsible, they gave him this little sticker called Bear Hug. The school is called Bear Creek. And when you collected four of those stickers or three of those stickers, you have to go to the principal's office and pick out some silly, you know, tattoo or bouncy ball that you can leave on your living room floor for your dad to step on. Right? But here's the thing. My kids never came home and didn't tell me when they got rewarded when they got a bear hug. I got a bear hug today, Dad. For what? Oh, on the playground, there was a kindergartner fell off the swing, and I helped him up, and I brought him over to the teacher on duty. So you got to reward your values, right? You reward your values every single day, right? And it matters so much because that's how people know what they are. Every kid at school can tell you, be safe, be kind, be responsible. Every teacher can tell you, be safe, be kind, be responsible. And I think almost every parent who pays attention could tell you what they were as well, because they were in your face all the time. This is who we are. This is how we do things here. And when you set that up, it's super, super important as an organization as well, because when new people come in, right? Hey, guess what? We're not here to be more like you. You're here to be more like us. And this is what us means. This is what it means like to be part of this. And every successful business and every successful sporting team, right? I can tell you they have consistent success. There is a consistent set of shared values. Some do a better job defining them than others, but they are out there. Right now, my colleague from Way of Champions, Dr. Jerry Lynch, he works with a pretty good basketball team called the Golden State Warriors. They have four core values: joy, mindfulness, accountability, compassion. Right? Listen to Steve Kerr talk about the game. And he'll be talking about playing with fun and loving what we're doing, loving each other, all that sort of stuff, right? He talks about their values every single day. Let me show you this first. So how can you set this value system, right? A year ago, September, my daughter's 10-year-old soccer coach quit. And the club called me and said, John, can you be the coach? Right? And I said, okay, but I need a value system. So this took me 20 minutes. Showed up to practice, said to these 10-year-old girls, give me an adjective that describes a great team. And they said, what's an adjective? Right, so I thought.
That's classic.
But then these are the words that they came up with. Teamwork, encourager, helpful, sportsman, supportive, respectful, great attitude, fearless, trustworthy, hard worker, loyal, focused, positive, giving, caring, all that sort of stuff. And they signed it at the bottom, I commit to being the type of teammate described above. 20 minutes, I had a value system, right? I had a value system. No, I take it back. They had a value system. We had a value system, because they have to buy in. They own these values because they were their words, not mine, right? And then they committed. Now, what I do every day in practice, or what I did with this group, is I come and say, hey, this is the soccer component of it, but today's value is this, right? Today's value is being fearless. So we're gonna learn something new. What does that mean? It means I'm not afraid to make mistakes. It means I'm not afraid to try something new. Now, throughout practice, what I would do is I wouldn't just say, hey, great pass, great shot, right? I would say, hey, that's being fearless. I saw you try that. Do that again. I reward them for epitomizing the values that we hold as a group. And then what's really cool at the end of practice is I would sum up the soccer piece, and then I would say to the kids, do any of you want to give one of your teammates a shout out for epitomizing our value today? Tell me what she did. And then they start going out and calling out their teammates for being these things, or being the value of the day, right? Now we have a value system that they're being rewarded not just by their coaches, but by their teammates. And they're getting acknowledgement, right? One person, you know, we call this the rule of one. One person, one comment, one time, stick with a kid forever, right? And now we're catching them being good. We're catching them being what matters to us as a group. And over the course of the year, you know, what I say to the parents is, you know, on that way home, you're really going to have a conversation, maybe ask them, what's the value today? What's our value? And talk about that and how that applies not just in soccer, but off the field as well. So at the end of the year, they didn't give out an MVP. They didn't give out a most improved. I sat the team together. I had some little gift for every kid. But I went down, each kid or each value and talk about what that value meant, and then talk about the kid who epitomized it the most. And what was really cool was that as I talked about the value, they almost always looked at the person who was about to get acknowledged for that. So they started to recognize these things in each other. And that's awesome, right? So at the end of the year, we go down, I acknowledge all the kids, send them off to the hotel pool, say thanks to all the parents for being a part of this. And they are like, this is the best season of sport any of my kids, any age, has ever had, right? This has been awesome. She can't wait to play again. She loves this. She loves this team dynamic. It's so positive. It's so supportive. This is awesome. Been telling all my friends about this. We lost every game. We never won, right? We were in the wrong division. Right? But yet, we gave the people who are part of that a different way to measure success. And we gave them a different way to, you know, as parents, something to be loyal about, something to be proud about, right? And we also did it at the same time, raising the standard of what did it mean to be part of this team. And I think that's a huge part of it as well. Right, so this wasn't just, you know, sink to the lowest common denominator. It was, hey, this is what we do here. So at the end of the year, right, I think there was two, you know, one girl left because she moved, and one other girl left because she wanted to commit to something else and didn't have the time for this. Right? But we raised their standard as well, and we set the expectations high. So you can do this in 20 minutes. Now this year, when I had the group at the beginning, we spent 2 hours on goals and culture. And I asked the 32 girls, right, again, what are the qualities? And then we went around and said, raise your hand if you had that. And we picked out five, which was enjoyment and unity and accountability and competitiveness and sportsmanship. That's what they said they wanted to be held accountable for this year. This is what we taught this year. I think 3 to 4 to 5, that's a good number. 20, it's too many, right? But I had 20 minutes to get it done, right? So that's something you can do in your first practice and at least create a value system in your little kingdom, right? That kicks it forward a notch. Because this is something that's really resonated with me with a coach that I've connected with on the podcast, a guy named Mark Bennett from England, who was a special forces trainer. And he says, performance isn't an outcome, performance is a behavior. Right? Our job as coaches is to shape behavior, especially the younger athletes that you're working with. Right? How they perform is not how well they did in the race, because maybe they do fantastic in the race because they're bigger, faster, stronger than everyone else. But our job is not to focus on that, it's to focus on what are their habits, right? What do they do every day? Are they focused? Do they compete hard? Do they communicate? Right? Do they have good behaviors on and off? And it's not just misbehavior, but just do we instill the right behaviors in our athletes from a very young age that will allow them to be successful later on in whatever they do? And then do we get them to understand how important that is and own it? So one of the things that Mark has done in mentoring me as a coach is what I do when we're doing a practice is I come down and I sit the kids down and this is what we're going to do. And then I ask them, the two groups, the two teams playing whatever we're doing, I said, define for me what is acceptable look like, what is exceptional look like in this activity, and what is unacceptable. So they define what those things are, right? We have non-negotiables like competing hard and communicating well and being focused and all that. And then we say, how long can we compete in that zone of acceptable to exceptional? And when we move out of it, then practice stops and we reset. It was really hard to coach like that in the beginning because, you know, I started realizing it was very coach-centric. Right? And we use something in coding called guided discovery, right? You ask questions, they give you answers. But what you find is that kids usually spit out the answers that they think you want to hear, right? But they're not really tuned in to what is happening out here, so that they're so focused that they're learning it and they're figuring it out and they're getting better. So by doing this, what happens is they define what acceptable and exceptional looks like. And then when we stop, and I stop practice because we've fallen into unacceptable, I say, get your group, you've got 10 seconds, you start about 30 seconds, now it's down to about 10. Tell me what's not working, right? And then they come up with it, and then I might call on any kid in that group, hey, why did we stop it, right? And they need to know the answer. They have to be accountable for that answer, right? And I might call on any kid, so it's not just one, it's not just loud. Now, what I've learned in that process is that a lot more of my kids knew what's going on. You know, we'd have a bad practice, and I'd be really upset thinking that, oh, we all had a bad practice today. But no, really, there was three or four kids having a bad practice, right? And so I figured out that people were actually knew what was happening. And I gave them permission to start noticing it and calling it out the behaviors amongst their teammates, right? I gave them permission on the field. Soccer, obviously different than skiing, but in your area, I bet you can figure out ways how to do this, right? When does practice fall unacceptable? And will you stop it? Now, what I have gotten to the point with my group is that I then say to them, when did you notice that? Right? When did you notice that? And they'll say, oh, you know, the whole time. Why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you say anything? So now I have a group of 12-year-old girls who are not afraid to call each other out for not living up to the expectations of the group, the standards that they have all agreed to. Now in games, I say to them, so our last game, last weekend, I said, all right, what are you accountable for as a position group? And they say it, and I say, okay. So as a coach, as long as you will all be accountable for these things that you just told me, I will say nothing on the sideline. The game belongs to you. But as soon as I see you being unaccountable, I'm going to call you out on it. Right? I want you to do it. And it's one of the hardest things, right? But again, you know, I need athletes to be creative problem solvers and accountable on the field, so that has to be part of my practice. So I am day by day shaping behavior of this group, of these athletes, so that they are not afraid to be accountable, they understand what they're accountable for, and they're not afraid to hold each other accountable. And the ones who understand where people should be, they are solving problems on the field, so I don't have to. And so as Mark says, maybe the best coaches make themselves redundant, right? You get to a point where they're figuring it out. And certainly when someone's hurtling down the hill at 70 miles an hour, right, you better be redundant. You better be able to figure it out. Right? So that's something that's really stuck with me. On Our Way to Champions podcast, there's an hour I did with Mark. I think it's fascinating stuff that has really tweaked my coaching in a big, big way. So before I talk about parents, anyone have any questions on that? Yeah.
I do. I like what you're saying, but I'm struggling with the perspectives of the various athletes and what accountability they hold, because their perspective on loyalty, there's a barrier, right?
Okay.
So how do you say my expectation of loyalty or commitment is within this bandwidth, not this bandwidth? Because everybody's perspective is different.
So you get them. So the question is, right? If the value is loyalty, you get them to define what loyalty means. Right? You get them to say being loyal means whatever it does for that group. And again, within the context, loyalty might mean something different for your 10-year-olds than your 18-year-olds, and that's okay. We're still teaching loyalty all the way up. Like the definition of things can change, right? For an athlete who says enjoyment or fun, right, it's different for an 18-year-old than it is for an Olympian, but most Olympians still participate because they enjoy what they're doing. So I think the biggest thing is within your little kingdom, as a club, you can have a value, and then your kingdom should define that value. Does that make sense? Right? Because the more they define it, the more they're going to own it. Now, as the coach, You can say, no, that's not what loyalty means, right? Me being loyal to you as a coach doesn't mean I show up with lollipops every day, right? That's not loyalty, right? So we can help shape the definition. But I think the older the athletes get, and certainly, you know, what we would call middle school in the U.S., sort of, you know, 10, 11, 12, the more ownership of it they can take, I believe. Anyone else on that?
Yeah. I think this idea of performance being behavior of each other, I think I find that interesting. I just want to share a perspective from our national sports scientists. I was asking them what their fitness standards were, like, did you go skiing? We were looking for something similar. And what he said was they don't have a standard. There are no you can or cannot ski based on this level of fitness. What he said is what they focus on is the behaviors, because for every deficit, there's a behavior. So if they are seeing a deficit in this or that area, they will say something like, you are not doing this, or you're not focusing enough on this, or you're skipping these workouts, or you're, and I mean, obviously there's a safety aspect, but they put it and frame it in the sense of behaviors. And every time they address those behaviors and they see those things change, then the fitness improves. And if those behaviors do not change, then they are not screened because the behavior is not a fitness level.
Yeah.
I just jumped out of here because I think it's really a great bonus.
Yeah, and so Kip, I'll jump on top of that. And what Mark Bennett says that sticks with me sort of 2.0, he says, you know, in the two types of athlete, I call them performance and participation. Or he calls them performance and leisure. Right? That a performance athlete has nothing to do with the outcome. A performance athlete is an athlete who shows up, right, might shoot, you know, 98 in golf, goes to work with an instructor, the instructor says, go home and work on these two things, or three things, practice these before you come back next week, and then he or she goes home and does those things, that's a performance athlete, right? And a leisure athlete is someone who takes that, even if they shoot 72 right now, and goes home and doesn't do any of those things, or only does the things that they're good at, ignores, like you said, the strength and conditioning part, and gets away with it for now. And I think, especially with young kids, we look far more at outcomes to say, oh, that's the high performance athlete, and then we need to start looking at behaviors. Because if we instill the right behaviors, the outcomes will, if they have the genetics and the drive, outcomes might come, right? But if they, regardless of the outcomes when they're 11 or 12, if they don't have the right behaviors, it's probably not going to happen, right? So it's something I 100%, this has resonated with me a ton, this idea. And I think the younger the kids get, the less important the outcome is and the more important the behavior is. Anyone else on that? All right. So engaging parents, right? And this is, I think, finally, you know, our last chunk here. How do we engage parents in the process? I believe in every group that I've worked with, right, there's like some parents who totally get it, some who will never get it, and then a huge chunk in the middle. And we're not very good at taking the chunk in the middle and putting it on the good side, right? And usually the ones who really get it, it's like their fourth kid, they don't care. They're like, whatever. Don't hurt them. Right? But, you know, that whole group in the middle, there are certain behaviors and things they can do to help their kids that we need to teach them. Right? How can you be part of this culture that we're building? Right? How do we engage them and not just shut them out? So I think, first of all, that begins with this idea of trust. So this story here, this guy, his name was the Great Blondin, and he was a French tightrope walker, right? And he's come to Niagara Falls. This is him tightrope walking over Niagara Falls in the 1900s, 160 feet above the water. And he was this big showman, and he would, like, cook omelets out in the on the tightrope and everything. So one year he shows up with this cart, And he yells at 10,000 people. He's like, I'm the great one, and who thinks I can walk across the falls? And they're all screaming his name. He says, who thinks I can push the cart across the falls? And they're like, blonde. He says, who wants to get in the cart? Nobody. Right? Because trust is not about ability. Your athletes and their parents won't simply trust you because you were a great skier. You know a lot about the sport. Trust is about connection. Trust is about being all in. Right? Trust is about being believable. So don't just talk the talk, but you gotta walk the walk. It's about being dependable. Right? It's about admitting when you're wrong. That's what trust is. I think it's hard, right? I know my definition of trust changed when I had my own kids, and like, why would I trust someone just because they can kick a ball or throw a ball? The most important thing in my life, my kids, right? So until then, I just thought trust was, of course you should trust me, right? I was a professional soccer player. So we have to understand trust. We have to make sure that people want to get in the car. And that's about building that connection. That's about asking those questions of kids, you know, how can I coach you? It's about having open dialogue so that they're not afraid. Now we can set boundaries of we don't talk 24 hours after a race or whatever, and those are totally appropriate as long as they're set beforehand. But, and I work with organizations that are like, oh, our coaches don't talk to the parents. I'm like, how's that working for you? This is asking. Right? We have to build trust. And what I found is that by having a good open dialogue with parents, first of all, they're still, most of them are leery of intervening on behalf of their kids. Not all, but most. And when they do, it's really helpful information. But I remember I had a girl who was a phenomenal soccer player, and she was just having an awful day at practice. And I was getting on her over and over and over, and then finally one of her teammates comes over and she's like, her grandma died this morning. And I was like, it would have been super helpful. Right? So that trust with parents of, hey, this is what's going on, right? One of the girls I'm coaching now, her mom wrote me an email when I was on a plane yesterday. She's been really distracted. Her mom said, you know, she's divorced, and the dad is suing for more custody and trying to get her to leave and go move in with him. Is that going to affect the 12-year-old? Yeah. Right? That's very helpful to know. Right? Because on that day when she might not be there, I'm going to mind my words and just give her a hug. Right? Instead of saying, hey, what's wrong with you? Be like, hey, how you doing today? Is this okay? You want to be here? I want to make this a place to escape from all that, not another prison for you to walk into, right? Because that's what sport should be. It should be this escape. So one of the things I'll talk about the parents tomorrow, and I just was down at the USOC, their National Assembly, and I spent some time talking to different heads of performance for different sports, one of the Tiger Shaw from US Ski. I said, what can I tell parents in the ski world, right, that they need to do for their kids, right? And I think this is appropriate for coaches too. And he said, you know, three things, right? Job as parents, right? Help them develop passion and enjoyment for the sport. Don't make this something they dread. Make this something they love to do and look forward to. Number two, they have to own it. It has to belong to them. It's got to be their dreams, not your dreams. Because number three, when you have enjoyment and you have ownership, right, that builds intrinsic motivation to develop the right habits and to go and improve. Right? And I think this is us as well. We should always be ticking these boxes. You're loving what you're doing, right? Now, I think enjoyment's an important concept to understand. Enjoyment and pleasure are not the same things. Has anyone here ever run a marathon? All right, was there any pleasure mile 20 to 26? But can you still enjoy running, right? Enjoyment is the pursuit of those long-term things that you love, and hard work and dedication and demanding environments are a part of enjoyment, but not necessarily a part of pleasure. Sport doesn't have to be about pleasure, but it does have to be about enjoyment, right? So when we do these things, you know,